Over the past 20-plus years, I've moved from the young-old category through the middle-old years to join the fast-growing group of the old-old. The next category, designated by many of the experts, is inevitable crepitude. Yikes. Well, and then there's death. As oldsters go, I'm one of the healthy ones. Even so, I bruise easily, have experienced nasty bouts of sciatica that put a damper on easy mobility. My aged eyes do not adapt well to night driving, and the moles on my back and neck are apparently at the peak of their reproductive capacity. Even with hearing aids, I sometimes miss crucial parts of a lively conversation, or worse yet, the punchline. I hate that. I'm no longer the go-to person in times of trouble. I suspect it's become more like, let's not worry, Mom. Mine is no longer the central gathering place for family holidays. That's as it should be. Really, I'd just as soon not ever cook another turkey or layer another lasagna for 14. But I see how easy it could be to drift to the fringes of life. I'm aware that, although I'm important to a number of people, I'm no longer the most important person to anyone in the world. I miss that. I've lost a degree of faith in my competence. A few months back, on a less familiar route to the airport than the one I usually travel, I let my GPS bully me into taking a freeway exit that I knew would take me in the wrong direction. I knew in my gut that the GPS directions were wrong, but lacking the confidence of old, I followed them anyway. And memory? Billy Collins channels my own experience in his poem, Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. As if one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no telephones. Yet given all of this, the challenges of being old, the inevitability of increasing decay, and the certainty of death just around some too close corner, this is a happy time for me. I have a trail of mistakes tagging along behind me, but there's also a more heavily trafficked trail of good work and things done right. I realize that throughout my life, I've done the best I could, given my insights at the time. At this stage of life, with the children all raised and the responsibilities of full-time teaching behind me, I have the luxury of time to reflect, read, write, relax with friends and family. I no longer struggle for self-improvement. Like my old role model, Popeye the Sailor Man, I understand that I am what I am, that's all what I am. I'm at peace with that. The internet offers an abundance of advice on healthy aging, some detailed and complex, some simple and straightforward. The 10 steps to healthy aging made sense to me when I read them. But I've chosen 4 pillars of healthy aging over the 10-step plan because I can remember 4. They are nutrition, exercise, purpose, and connection. Between Raley's and Whole Foods, Cellin's and In-N-Out Burger, I have access to plenty of food choices. I live in a neighborhood that offers plenty of opportunity for safe, pleasant walking. I belong to a gym and even sometimes go there. I find a sense of purpose through teaching stints with at-risk teens and through a writing life. As for connection, I'm grateful for the UUS community. I'm fortunate to have a large, loving, extended family and lucky to have a number of close friendships. These connections bring me joy and are crucial to my well-being. But there's also a sense of connection that reaches far beyond my immediate circle, a sense that though I'm smaller than a speck of dust in this vast universe, I'm nevertheless a part of it all. I like life and hope that I've got several good years left, but whether it's years or months or days, I trust that the universe is well-ordered and benign, and that whatever does or does not come after this life is nothing to fear.
We are indeed blessed. You're a hard act to follow, Marilyn Reynolds. Let alone you, Wayne Wilcox. I'll take another sip of water, then you'll forget about that and you can pay attention to me. So, I'm turning 60 next month. No, everybody does it. If you live 59 years, it's the next thing that happens. I was born in 1957. The largest number of people ever were born in that year in the United States of America. It was the peak of the baby boom. So there's lots of folks turning 60 this year. And of course, as us boomers do with everything that happens to us, we act like we invented it. In fact, I'm kind of hearing that 60 is the new 50. Huh. I wonder what that's about. I can imagine part of it is that 60 feels kind of old. I do know who I'm talking to, who's in the audience, so who's in the congregation. But 60 feels kind of old. And in our youth culture kind of, the youth culture that we swim in, some people might want to imagine that they're resetting back to 50 rather than 60. Or maybe 50 is the new 60 because somehow you can imagine that you haven't quite got to that place in your life where you have less time ahead of you than you've had behind you. Or maybe we say 60 is the new 50 because of negative ideas about aging that many of us harbor. I can list them. You probably know what they are. The body's going, the mind's not as sharp, greater possibility of illness, pain, limitations, and of course the presence of death. I think a big part of wanting somehow to reset down to 50 is the sense of the unknown. You're getting to a place in your life where you're not really sure what's next, as if you knew that when you were in your 20s. But still that fear persists. But you know, the fact is, aging is not as bad as everything you've heard about it. And Marilyn, of course, gave us a lovely example of that. But the research shows it to be true, right? We need the research on these sorts of things. Elders are happier than younger people. A very large sample found that happiness actually has an arc. And the arc goes up, you get happier and happier as you get older. It does start to decline in your 90s, but it never gets as low as it was in your 20s. Huh. Well, they found that elders have less stress, less worry and frustration. They have greater appreciation for the smaller things in life, greater enjoyment, satisfaction. And this research, of course, probably brought on by the boomers, because there's so many of us, tried this novel idea. Instead of projecting what we think aging will be like, we asked the elderly what they thought. We asked them about their experience. One study I heard on a TED Talk that I just found really intriguing had a large sample size of people ages 20 to, I think the oldest person was 97. They followed them for 10 years, and the people all carried a pager. And at random times, your pager would go off and you would have to answer a series of 10 questions about how happy you were at that time. So they traced people for 10 years through their own lives, and then they traced this large sample as they moved through 10 years of their life. So those of us who are under 60, me included, of course, for 3 more weeks or 4 more weeks, Why do we find ourselves surprised that elders are happier? I think we project some of our fears onto the older years of our lives, so we assume that it can't be a happy, satisfying time. We make the wrong comparisons. You know, we say if you're in pain, you can't really be as happy, or if you have less mobility, you're going to be frustrated. But we heard from Marilyn, and I know many of you are living the fact that elder years can be a very important time of growth. Psychologists and sociologists have studied developmental phases of our lives, and again have started giving more attention to the later phases of life, and have learned that the developmental tasks are very different in our later years than they are in our earlier years. Erik Erikson pioneered this thinking in the 50s. He had 8 stages of development, and 6 of them are in the first part of your life. You know, we know this, where you're growing and changing through your 20s and 30s, and there's a developmental task for each stage of life that you need to accomplish in order to move successfully onto the further developmental tasks. So I wanted to focus on the two stages for the middle years and the elder years. The first the seventh developmental stage out of the eight is one of generativity versus stagnation. So generativity in the idea of creativity, engagement, generative events versus stagnation. This is the developmental challenge of 40, 50 to 60, 70, that midlife kind of period, midlife to beginning elder kind of period. So this is when your career is kind of set, or you're preparing to retire from your career, your family is established. You've developed this sense of your role as part of the bigger picture, giving back to society, being productive. These are some of the most productive years of people, their 40s to their early to mid-60s. So the objective here is to figure out how to stay active and engaged rather than lose the sense of your role in the world, than stagnate. So people who are stuck in a rut in this life, this is part of the midlife crisis. Who am I? What's happening next for me? To successfully transition through that developmental stage, you need to stay engaged and creative and find ways to have agency and contribute to the world. Now, as we move into the next phase of life, the 65 or 70 plus period, this is a time when we slow down our productivity in sort of the capitalist kind of sense and start exploring our life in different ways, contemplating our accomplishments. And the developmental task at this stage of life is ego integrity versus despair. Now, what do I mean by ego integrity? Ego integrity is kind of having a healthy awareness of who you are in this stage of life and what life means to you. Whereas despair is being caught up in your sadness about your failures, feeling like the things that you wanted to accomplish will never happen. You can see how easy it would be to tip in those two directions. But the challenge is to find that sense of who you are in this world, be aware of what you've contributed, and allow yourself to feel good about yourself. Allow yourself to have a healthy, strong sense of your own worth and your own value, who you are now in this moment in your life. Success at this developmental task will lead to wisdom. Now, I'm not thinking about gurus on the top of the mountain. I'm thinking of the wisdom that enables the person to look back on their life with a sense of closure and completeness. A sense of wisdom that allows someone to accept death without fear. A challenging task. Maybe a task that you've been working up to for your whole life. All of these developmental tasks throughout our lives have a spiritual dimension to them. I think possibly the eighth stage of life might have the most profound spiritual dimension. Now, every time I use the word spiritual or I talk about spirituality or spiritual practice, I get a lot of people asking me what I mean by that term. And we're going to be starting up our spiritual deepening circles, our small groups, next month. We're going to be advertising them and getting people to sign up. So I wanted to take this chance to talk just a little bit about spirituality, particularly with the awareness of the importance of spirituality in our elder years. When we talk about something being spiritual, we really mean something that is an aspect of our core nature, not our mind, not our body, not our all of it. Almost the word soul, I know that is a challenging word for some people, but the idea of your spirit is what your essential nature is, your vital energy. And I see spirituality and spiritual practice as the task of aligning the energies of the outside world with that essential core spirit of who you are. Whether this the larger energies of the world to you are the interdependent web of all existence, whether it's God, whether it's nature, whether it's just the vital pulse of the universe, the spiritual task is to align your own spirit, your own vital sense with those energies of the outside world. So this primary spiritual task of the elder years is moving from to ego integrity rather than despair. Finding that resonance with who you are in the world, where you've come from, and your place in the world as an elder. Integrity versus despair. Much easier said than done. Much easier said than done. You can imagine some of the challenges of aging would say that tipping over into despair would be an easy way to go when faced with that developmental task. But there are many excellent examples of people who have successfully or are engaged successfully with that developmental task and are moving clearly or are living within that integrity of ego and a positive sense of who they are. Many of them are sitting right out here in our congregation. One of our gifts, one of the wonderful gifts of this congregation is all our elders who share their wisdom and engage with us in profound ways. We were working on our pastoral care team last year, and Reverend Martha and I printed a list of all the congregants that we have who are over 80, because we wanted to make sure there wasn't someone out there in the world who wasn't able to come to church anymore, that was getting disconnected. We wanted to reach out to everyone. So we're going down the list, and we're like, oh yeah, him, yeah, he's the head of the grasshoppers. He mows the lawn once a week. Oh yeah, she's in charge of this committee. Oh yeah, this person, you know, runs this program. Active, engaged elders, fully present with our community, one of our true gifts. Now, this idea of this struggle, this task of ego integrity versus despair, of course, is harder when you have pain or physical limitations, especially harder when you have mental limitations. But I have to say, it's not impossible. I've talked about this struggle. Some of it is a natural form of grace that occurs. We've had members of this congregation, one member in particular I'm thinking of, whose mother had been critical and harsh of her entire life. And then stricken by Alzheimer's, living in a memory care facility, for the first time in this person's life, her mother was able to tell her that she loved her. Some softening, some awareness allowed for that connection. And the mother softened in that love as well and connected with the daughter. We don't ask ourselves the worth of the mother and her diminished mental capacity. That was the event that occurred, a moment of grace between the two of them. So in order to think about this spiritual task of aging, some scientists, sociologists have said we need a different lens for how we view aging. And one of them is a Swedish sociologist named Lars Tornstam. Some of you may have heard of his work from the 90s. He calls it gerotranscendence. Gero comes from of the aged, and transcendence is this idea of creating new, larger meaning and purpose in your life in your elder years. His idea is that those who are engaged, fully engaged in this task of living as an elder, are working to redefine themselves in the final phase of their life. The transcendent term is used because there's a shift. There's a shift that happens to a larger perspective, a meta perspective, from a materialistic and rational view of the world to a more transcendent one. So Tornstam has some dimensions of gerotranscendence that he has outlined. The first dimension is the cosmic dimension. And this comes out of his research and surveys with
hundreds, perhaps thousands of elders, that there's a changing sense of time. Doesn't feel as linear. Decreased fear about death, concern about the dying process itself, but decreased fear about death. More accepting of paradox and mystery. He's found among elderly that there's less need to be right, less need to figure out what is right, and more of an understanding that some questions do not have answers. In this cosmic dimension, small things take on more meaning and can even have an element of secret joy. Deeper connections across generations. And for a lot of elders, childhood experiences become more alive and more important to remember and engage in than immediate experiences. Tornstam's second dimension is the self. During this time of aging and challenge to find that ego integrity, he's found that elders will continue to discover new sides of themselves, discover new relationships. There was a great article in the New York Times recently about a couple that got married at 98 and 94, and they were looking forward to spending the rest of their lives together. In this self dimension, there's less need to feel significant. A growing sense of altruism. And this idea that life forms a more coherent whole. In the social dimension, elders report a growing need for positive solitude. They become more choosy about social relationships. They don't want to spend time with people who don't enrich them or make their lives better. One that I think culturally be aware of, he calls emancipated innocence. I just love that. It's the red hat societies. How many people have heard of these women who like, I'm going to wear my red hat and I don't damn well care what you think about it. It's this idea of spontaneity that moves beyond expected social norms. I'm going to be who I am. Emancipated innocence. I wish we all could have emancipated innocence. I love that. For elders, material assets become less important. And I found this to be so true with elders that I've interacted with. With this greater sense of life's ambiguity, they become less prone to give wisdom advice. Have you ever asked an elder, well, you're a wise old man. What do you think about it? And they're like, hey, I'm still figuring out myself. Awareness of the paradoxes of life that some will never, we live these paradoxes, we don't solve them. My father is going to be 92 next week, and we spent some quality time together Thursday in the emergency room at Kaiser Roseville. He's struggling with congestive heart failure, and since he's really the late 80s, there's been a series of additional limitations. The current one is that he can't eat salt anymore. But he was my one-man focus group because I went over my sermon with him. I said, well, since we're hanging out here in the emergency room, can we talk about my sermon? It was nice to have his perspective on these things. And it's fascinating to experience the challenges that he goes through. And my question for him that I always ask, so he's very upset about not having salt anymore. And so I say, what makes life worth living? Is life worth living without salt? When you're 92, that's a really reasonable question. As you're facing, this is one of the questions we ask people that are coming close to death. What makes life worth living? What do you want to stay alive for? Because the conversations with my father are either, nobody should live this long. This comes up quite a bit. Nobody should live this long. Okay, well, let's talk about that. And then the question of when some additional limitation and more are coming. He still drives at 92. I'll give you his address so you can avoid being on the streets where he is. Can you enjoy life sufficiently without salt? And he says he's going to ponder that question. I can see him working through this developmental challenge. He's a very verbal person, as is his daughter, and I can see him working through these developmental challenges, trying to keep despair at bay. One of the most important tasks in this developmental challenge is taking inventory. This will happen automatically, but some elders are very intentional about it, and my father is one of those elders. One of the books I read, From Aging to Saging, you gotta love the titles of these books about aging, talks about the idea of harvesting a life, the elder task of harvesting a life. It's important to recover the memories, especially those that haunt you, that remain incomplete or unresolved. The process is recontextualizing the difficult outcomes. I see my father doing that, and he did it in a 2-volume book of his memories. He wrote stories about every aspect. Volume 1 only goes up to the age of 20, and volume 1 has like 600 pages in it. But through that process, he made peace with the undone things in his life, the unresolved things in his life. He shared the stories with my family, and every year on my parents' anniversary and on my father's birthday, we act out one of the stories in his memoirs. We act out the story of my parents' elopement, or we act out an important event in my father's life. It's becoming part of our family, the legacy that my father has left. Taking inventory. The developmental task of ego integrity versus despair. An elderhood of satisfaction and growth. These are all the challenges and the possibilities. Did I mention that I was turning 60 next month? I think one way that with this idea of 60 is the new 50 is that there are now more years in the last stage of life. It used to be for my grandparents that you retired 65 or so, and then at some point 5 years after that, maybe not even that, that was it. You died. So in this era now, we have people who will spend 20 or more years in this elder period. My father retired 30 years ago. Part of the reason that I chose this topic is because, did I tell you I'm turning 60 next month? It's a roadmap. My father's life is a roadmap. The elders in this community and in my life are a roadmap. I have tremendous respect for all of our members who are engaged in their elder years. Keep doing what you're doing. Please tell me your stories. Tell me your challenges. Help me be a companion for you as you do this life inventory, as you harvest the life that you have. But you need to know that I'm watching and I'm learning. And I'm following in your footsteps. Namaste.